Hey, listeners, I know we promised to have Veronica Freeman on the show this week, but due to the rearrangement of the record release schedule, I think due to the old global release day, and that record has been pushed up to July 24th, we had to push out the Veronica episode a few weeks, but I promise you, you will be hearing Veronica very, very soon. In the meantime, we bring you a great interview that Richie did with James Christian of House of Lords, who recently released their latest one, Indestructible. As a bonus, you now get a few extra weeks to pre-order the V's, now or never.
Hi, this is James Christian from the House of Lords, and you are listening to Focus on Metal. Listen up. Focus on
Metalheads, Scott here.
I'm Richie.
Welcome you to yet another week right here on Focus on Metal. Got a great show for you this week, and we will be talking with, or actually I should say Richie will be talking with, James Christian.
Yep, just me. I set it up and I said to Scott, he's all mine.
Yeah, so he's soloing on this one. Lots of good stuff, good stories and stuff, and I think everyone's going to enjoy that. But before that, how about a track of the week? So the album for track of the week this week was very, very easy to pick. Just the actual track off the album, that was a little bit trickier. And of course, the album I'm talking about is the just recently released Massacre Records compilation called A Light in the Black, a tribute to Ronnie James Dio. Great 2-CD tribute to the man himself. Great stuff. And how many times do you actually get a 2-CD tribute collection? But a ton of great Massacre artists contributed to this one. You know, Crystal Ball, who is going to be a future guest here on the show, the band Messenger, Gun Barrel, former guest Gloryful. We had Johnny LaBamba from Gloryful on Focus to Metal a while back. Got The Order, Metal Inquisitor, Circle of Silence, Burden of Grief, Rebellion, and Iron Fate Wizard. And the track I picked is from a band called Love Might Kill. These guys have got two albums out, obviously, on Massacre. There was Brace for Impact and also Big to Fail, which came out in 2012. This guy's first album got pretty much co-written and produced by Michael Eyre, who's the drummer from Firewind. He also worked for Uli John Roth. And he's also pretty well known for being one of the main contributors to Metallium, one of my favorite bands. If you want to find out more about the band, you can hit him up at lovemightkill.de. Love Might Kill contributed two tracks to this tribute compilation. They covered the track Hungry for Heaven, of course, a classic Dio track right there. And also they covered our track of the week this week, Stand Up and Shout. I urge you to go pick this one up. Great tribute to the mighty Dio. Two CDs full of great Dio tracks covered by some great Massacre artists. Great buy for your metal dollars. So here it is off of A Light in the Black, a tribute to Ronnie James Dio. This is Love Might Kill with Stand Up and Shout.
You get confused.
there you go. Track of the week this week right here on Focus on Metal. And of course, Richie has said that before we dive into his talk with James, he has a bit of stuff on his mind.
Yeah. Coverdale's new record, the Purple album.
Yeah.
Whitesnake.
Yeah.
Getting a lot of flack. I'm not entirely surprised. But Coverdale is, he's coming out with fists flying. I got the new Classic Rock magazine and it's been on the blabbermouths. He's calling out the fans saying that they've, you know, go back down to your base, your mother's basement, and I've sold 100 million albums. What have you done? Kind of, kind of deal. Do I get where he's coming from? I do. Do I admire him for being honest? I do.
Yeah.
I've heard the record. I don't like all of it. You're dealing with three albums that a lot of, you know, I think that when you talk about Purple, I think, I love the Coverdale Glenn Hughes era.
Yeah.
And I love the Gillan era.
Right.
And, like, I even like the album they did with Joel and Turner.
Right.
Not, but I like the albums more than others. Right.
Uh-huh.
Burn is a Stone Cold classic. Stormbringer. I love Stormbringer. And I think Come Taste the Band is probably, you know, a lot of Purple fans might think that that's like, you know, the runt of the litter, but I think it's a great record.
Right. Well, I think, you know, it's interesting, and I maybe because, you know, I've gone through all those eras and I don't really think much about it, but I'm sure that part of this is probably coming out of the fact that there's going to be a ton of people, right, that know Whitesnake from 1987 on.
Yes.
And I'm sure that a vast majority of those people also aren't aware that there was a Whitesnake before 87 with great players like Bernie Marsden and stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that David Coverdale was in this other band called Deep Purple.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, to me, I mean, it's part of his legacy. And if he wants to go back and celebrate it, I think great, good for him. And the fact that he didn't do made his guitar players do spot on recreations of everything. He let Joel and Reb do what they wanted to do with solos and things like that. I think that's great. If you don't like it, I mean, it's okay, but I don't think you need to give him shit about it. He's celebrating another era. I think it's pretty cool that he did it like that. I also think that if he'd had the opportunity to have a full-blown Purple reunion instead, he probably would have gone that way, and then you would have just got a regular Whitesnake album. You know?
Yeah. I just think that, I don't know whether you have it, but I bought it when it came out. When they reissued, all the albums, and they did Come Taste the Band a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And Kevin Shirley remixed it. And in my opinion,
Did he do it in a day?
He probably did it in lunchtime. And he did an incredible job on it.
Uh-huh.
But of course, you're remixing and tweaking around with an album that a lot of people consider a classic.
Yeah.
So he got flack for just remixing the thing.
Yeah.
Right? So now you have Coverdale, who actually sang on these albums.
Yeah.
He goes in to record the songs again. Right. Uh-huh. Now let's look at the band that they had. They had, you have Glenn Hughes on vocals, right? Yeah. It's Glenn Hughes, right? And you had Ian Paice.
Yeah.
And you had John Lord. And you had Tommy Bolan. And you had Richie Blackmore.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, the band he has now are fantastic. Don't get me wrong, right?
Yeah.
But they don't have Glenn Hughes singing in it, right? Now, I know Reb did a lot of the background vocals, and Reb's a great singer,
yeah.
But he's not Glenn Hughes,
right?
Coverdale himself can't sing the way he used to sing,
yeah.
Right? So there's that against him as well. Now, if he wants to go and do it, I've no problem with him doing it,
right?
But like, to expect everyone to say, "Oh, it's great," and you know, and not get any criticism at all,
yeah,
I think is in this day and age is a bit ridiculous. Like, if people want to hide behind pseudonyms and you know, false names and all that, and say, "Oh, it's a load of crap," without hearing it, that's fine. But the one thing is, I've heard the record. A lot of people were coming out criticizing it before they'd heard it.
Yeah.
Now, like the songs that work for me are the ones where he stripped them down.
Yeah.
Sail Away is brilliant. It's a brilliant version of it. But some of the other tracks like Burn, Stormbringer, he's kind of rocked them up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's missing a little bit of the nuances that the earlier classics had. An album like that, you know me now, a couple of years. I'm not a huge remake kind of guy.
Right.
If Coverdale wants to do this, great.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean I have to like it. And that doesn't mean he should be criticizing me and telling me to go to my mother's basement, right? Which I, if he wants to say that, that's fine. I like they're playing in a couple of weeks, so I'm planning on going to see him.
And if you happen to be up at the Hampton Beach Casino Ballroom on July 22nd, Richie and I should be roaming about the place during the Whitesnake show.
It's probably the only chance I'm going to get to see a lot of these songs performed.
Yeah.
I don't think the Deep Purple reunion thing is ever going to happen, because in the interviews, Coverdale is saying that, you know, he's 63 now. He's actually reconnected with Richie. They were actually talking about doing something, and it never panned out. The one thing I would be curious to see is what's Glenn Hughes' reaction to all of this? Because if you look at any of the documentaries out there in interviews, Glenn has always been the one that's talked about reuniting with that lineup. I think more than David. And now David went in and did a record doing all those tracks. So I don't know. I'm just curious to see if in interviews now, if Glenn has something to say in the near future about all that.
Yeah. Well, do you think that there would have been a different reaction to this new album if after Doug left and Joel comes in, that they had done a proper Whitesnake album, like a new album of original music? Do you think that part of the backlash of this is the fact that maybe people are going, oh, well, geez, he's got this new guy in the band and he just wants to get product out and he's just throwing this out there? Do you think that that's maybe part of it?
Well, we talked about this, and I said a couple of months ago, we talked to Reb in December, and we knew they were doing a project. Now, Reb didn't tell us before the interview that we couldn't talk about it, but I didn't want to ask him because it was, you know, I wanted them to announce something. And I just didn't ask him at the time. Now, we knew Joel was in the band.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that Brian Sword in the Double Stop did an interview with Joel. And Joel knew what they were doing. And he said he was under sworn orders not to say anything, right? When they actually announced that they were doing a remake of all the Purple stuff, I was amazed. I was like, what? No way. They're actually going to remake all the Purple stuff. And of course, the first thing that came to mind was Coverdale 63. And he didn't want to blood in a new songwriter at this stage in his life. Now, when we spoke to Reb about it, if he said, oh, you don't know David at all. Obviously, we don't know him.
Right.
I've never talked to him. I've never interviewed him. You know, have you heard any of the album?
I have not heard any of the album.
You've not heard any of the album. Okay.
Okay. Relax. At the time we did this, I hadn't gotten the album yet. So yeah, I hadn't heard it. I've heard it now. It's pretty good. Some songs better than others. But at the time we did this, I hadn't heard it.
Classic Rock hammered it. Absolutely hammered it. Said that. Why? And that's one of the questions I have. Is like, it's a project for David himself. I think if you take it at face value at that and say, look, he wanted to do it himself, and he wanted to release it, that's fine.
Yeah.
But it's not going to make me go back and listen. You know, I'm still going to go back and listen to the other albums. I listened to this once and I didn't even get through the whole thing. And I was like, no, I just can't.
Yeah.
If Whitesnake want to go out and play these songs and live, they've done Burn before. I think they've done Stormbringer in the past before. That's one thing. But to actually go back and record a whole album of Deep Purple tracks that he recorded, it just left me scratching my head a little bit.
Yeah.
And some of it is good. I'm not saying it's all crap.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it is really good. But as a whole, I'm not going to probably play it ever again, to be honest.
Wow.
Don't tell David that, though.
Man. Well, as far as albums that you would want to play again, of course, this week's guest is going to have a brand new album out.
Oh, House of Lords. Oh, fantastic record. Just amazing. The run of form that band has been on in the last 10 years, it's every 2 years they bring out an album, and just solid.
Yeah.
Just if you're like your heavy, really heavy, riffy, melodic rock, you can't go wrong with this band.
Yeah.
I think they're at the top. James, I think, vocally, still sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, he's got Robin Beck, his wife, does the backing vocals. So you're top-notch melodic vocals. And a tremendous band with him. in Jimmy Bell, BJ Zampa, and Chris McCarvel. Just an incredible band.
Jimmy Bell is definitely one of those under-the-radar guitar players.
Fantastic player.
Yeah.
He's been with him for 10 years. Like, he's kept more or less the same lineup,
yeah,
which in this day and age is unusual,
yeah,
to say the least. And like, the new record is just about to come out,
mm-hmm,
and it's getting great reviews. And again, it's like song after song after song after song, just incredible melodic hard rock.
Yeah.
One of the best albums I've heard this year.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Wow.
Definitely. Just an incredible record.
Yeah.
And I thought the last one was good, and I thought the one before that was fantastic. And I just look at James now and I'm thinking, when is the well run dry with this guy?
Yeah.
He's just on a roll, and just an incredible album.
Yeah, well, really, I mean, you know, the interview, it's obvious the guy still has a lot of passion for what he's doing and stuff, and definitely seems he's got plenty of gas in the tank to do more. So,
yeah,
you know, that's how he comes across in the interview. So
yeah, and he still seems, you know, he's in a good place in life. I didn't bring it up in the interview, but I know around the time of Big Money, he had a health scare,
mm-hmm,
and you know, but he got over that, and he's firing on all cylinders again. Solo record as well a couple of years ago. So, like, I don't know where all the songs keep coming from, but I'm just glad that he just keeps bringing them out.
Awesome.
Because every album he brings out with House of Lords, I'm thinking, maybe that's it now.
Yeah.
And then, I'm in the studio on a new House of Lords album. Like, oh, wow. So keep them coming. I'll keep buying them.
Yeah.
Just fantastic stuff.
Awesome. Awesome. Good. All right. So let's, ready to roll your interview with James?
My interview.
That's it. It's Richie's solo interview. I didn't do one single word on it. So it's all Richie on this one. Let's start it out by rolling a track off of the brand new House of Lords release called Indestructible. This one is called Stand and Deliver. And from here, we'll go right into Richie's talk with James Christian of House of Lords.
Hey listeners, this week we have someone I've been waiting since probably 1988 to talk to. I've been a big fan for many years, and that is the great James Christian from the House of Lords. So how are you doing tonight, James?
I'm doing great, thank you very much.
So we're going to dive into the House of Lords discography. You have a little bit of history just before the band with Chuck Wright, but you never actually met him face to face. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
About Chuck Wright?
Yeah, before you joined House of Lords, you had a little bit of history with Chuck, but you actually never met him face to face. You knocked on his door to drop off a cassette.
Well, I don't know how you got that story, but yes, I That's how it happened. A friend of mine, I was staying at the house of guitar player for Paul McCartney and Wings. His name was Paul Juber. Lawrence Juber. And I got information that Quiet Riot was looking for a new singer. So they encouraged me to go to this address and drop off a cassette, which I did do. When I knocked on the door, no one opened it, but I did hear a voice saying, "Who is it?" and whatever. And I introduced myself, and he said, "Well, just drop the cassette off." Back then it was cassettes. Drop the cassette off, leave it on the front door, and I'll listen to it and get back to you. And I never really heard from him afterwards. And it was a year later that we ended up working together on a band that I was hired to work with called L.A. Rocks. Mm-hmm. And Chuck came in as a hired gun to replace the bass player that left the band. So we were doing showcases for record companies, and they hired Chuck. And the first thing Chuck said was, "Hey, your voice sounds so familiar. You know, I just can't put my finger on it." And that's when I initiated and said, "Well, Chuck, I left a cassette of mine on your doorstep a year ago, but you never got back to me." And then that's when he said, "I can't believe that's you. I tried calling you back, but that phone number was disconnected." And it was, because I'd come back. I'd left for L.A.
Okay.
At that time. So we never really, my fault. I had to leave a forwarding number. So he did try to contact me, but we never did hook up till that day. And at that moment, Chuck pulled me aside and said, "I need to speak with you, and let's have lunch." We did, and he told me about the House of Lords project and that I needed to meet Gene Simmons and Greg Giuffria, and that there was quite a few singers, but he felt confident that I could be the one. And one thing led to another. I went through the process of meeting Gene, meeting Greg, auditioning for Gene, auditioning for Greg. Very stressful, but in the end, you know, it was my gig.
Yeah, so
my time. So.
Yeah, do you remember what you sang at the audition?
I sang Edge of Your Life, Jealous Heart, and Love Don't Lie.
Okay, so they'd already sent you the demos with, was it David Glenn Isley's vocals on them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the only song that wasn't, the only song that, really there was two songs that were not David Glenn Isley's songs, and that was Love Don't Lie and Edge of Your Life, which Lanny had wrote.
Yeah.
But Jealous Heart, they wanted to find out the range ability, so Jealous Heart was given to me to learn, and that one had quite a bit of a range.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was between those three songs, and basically I sang them in Greg's home, and he played keyboards, and I sang, and Gene came in, and like I said, it's one of those situations where, you know, it's extremely stressful to be put under the microscope like that, but if you don't do it correctly and you don't, you know, do it, you're not going to get the gig. So
yeah,
I did what I had to do, and I never looked back because I got the gig immediately afterwards.
Yeah. Now, was the band already called House of Lords? Did they already had the name?
Actually, yes, they had the name already.
Okay. And do you remember who came up with the name?
Gene Simmons.
Oh, it was Gene came up with it.
Yeah. He came up with the name. They were going to call the band Balance of Power. And to this day, I think I'm so glad they didn't use that name. It just, you know, it just never fit. But I remember Gene, you know, telling me the story and that he had heard the music. And he goes, "This is just so royal. The music has got a majestic sound to it." And then he said, I blurted out House of Lords. And that was the end of that. So,
yeah.
And then Gene basically, because I was the young guy in the band and the greenhorn, who really, really had no experience in the big stage or, you know, recording records, he basically was in the studio every evening that I was doing my vocal. And he was also the guy that took me on all the promotional tours, him and myself, so that I could be introduced to the public.
Wow.
And he was really amazing at how he worked it. And back then, I really didn't realize just how amazing the opportunity was. You know, as you get on older in years, you realize, wow, what you just did was pretty incredible and pretty, you know, dreamlike. You know, stuff that really doesn't always happen in everyday life.
Yeah. Now, you have some co-writes on the debut record. Was that vocal melodies and lyrics you brought in, or did you actually bring some instrumentation in, play guitar or something like that?
Well, on the debut album, that record was pretty much recorded. The music was already done. Yeah. They were just waiting for the voice to come in. And they had brought in Andy Johns to produce the record. And Andy was kind of offstandish because I was just like the young guy coming in. And I guess I had to prove myself to a guy who's worked with the best musicians and greatest singers in the world, from Robert Plant to Rolling Stones. Not Mick Jagger is a great singer, but Mick Jagger is a great singer in his own right. Mm-hmm. So that's the way I look at it. But Andy Johns was ended up being a very close friend of mine. After our first album together, I was in headlocks because I wasn't listening to his direction, and I remember all the things that were happening back then. And Andy liked to tell stories while I was doing my vocal, and I'd have to stop him, and I'd say, Andy, I'm on a roll right now. I need to keep going. And so that's when he would come out of the studio and put me in the headlock and say, listen, you little shit, you know, because I was, you know, I just started. And I guess he was just trying to make the point that he controls the studio.
Yeah.
So we ended up having a great friendship after that record, and right up until the time that he passed away.
Yeah. Is it true it took 5 days for you to do the vocals for the album?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. It was just an amazing... They gave me that amount of time because RCA was now taking over the record. It was signed under Gene Simmons' label, mm-hmm. called Simmons Records. And then when they heard the first couple of tracks, RCA decided that they were going to take it over from Gene and do their promotion. In other words, instead of using Gene's promotion engine, they were going to use the whole full force of RCA Records, yeah. to promote House of Lords. So they gave me five days to do it. So basically I was doing two songs a day. Okay. And very little time to recheck. And, you know, sometimes I really trusted Andy Johns, because at that point I really had no experience as to what I was doing or what I was really looking for. I sang the songs 3 or 4 times, and Andy said, I'll comp it and you're going to love it. Obviously he knew that I had all the parts, as I did them, so I never really got to listen to anything till after the album was actually mixed.
Okay.
Really, really not knowing what was the end result. But when it was done, I listened to it and went, wow. I mean, it's not perfect in every way, shape, or form, but that's what I loved about it.
Yeah.
That there was just a rawness about it. It's almost like when you do a demo vocal, and the demo always sounds better than actually when you go to record it, because you're in a different place. Your frame of mind is not, I've got to get it perfect. It's more, I want to make it emotional. So I like that.
Like the night, she bites like a snake.
Can you remember your first live show with the band?
Okay, first live show with the band was actually a showcase that we did for the album party.
Okay.
Which, and the album party was, oh my goodness. Let me just get all of this together here in my mind. Because the first actual live show I did was Palace Theater.
Okay.
In Hollywood, California. Mm-hmm. And that one was, I mean, it was maybe about 2,000 people there in the room. It was pretty, you know, it was all industry-related people that came to that show. And then right after that, we were on tour with the Cheap Trick for mm-hmm. a year and a half. So, and that was really my learning ground, was working with Cheap Trick and having to endure, in a wonderful way, Rick Nielsen and Robin Zander, who were just, you know, kind of intimidating characters in the very beginning, but ended up being, again, very close friends, the respect. And once you get to know these guys, they were the best. I ended up spending more time on their bus than I was on my bus.
Yeah, and you did some shows with the Scorpions too, didn't you?
Yes, we did about 3 months in Europe with Scorpions, and then maybe 5 shows with Ozzy.
Okay. And yeah. Did Lanny leave when the tour was over, or was it during the tour?
No, he left when the tour was over.
Okay, so of course you had to search for a new guitarist for the next record. So can you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, the search, that was, it was amazing. And the thing was, I was actually involved in that process, which was impressive to me, because this was still only my second record. So the tapes started coming in from guitar players all over the world. And one of them was Joe Satriani. And I remember going, I love this guy. This guy sounds great. And the rest of the guys going, well, he doesn't look the part for House of Lords. I said, but yes, but he's fucking amazing. You know, I said, he's fucking, you know, he's like incredible. And I'll never forget telling the story, because it just amazed me that he didn't get the gig. Yeah. So I think maybe a month passed. We listened to 101 tapes of different guitar players, and we ended up choosing Michael Guy. And Michael worked, by that time, we had already recorded the record with a guitar player, Doug Aldrich. Mm-hmm. We did all the tracks with Doug, but Doug couldn't join the band officially because he was in a band called Hurricane.
Yeah.
So we could not, we really wanted Doug. We really, really wanted Doug, but it just couldn't happen contractually. So we found Michael Guy. Michael was fine. Michael was a good guitar player, and everything would have worked fine, but the chemistry just wasn't right. You know, and when you get into a room and you start playing together, it's got to feel right. It's got to have all the elements of what you have on your record. So it didn't work out. So we turned to Doug Aldrich again, and we said, Doug, just do the tour. So we did the tour with Doug. It was amazing. I knew Doug was a world-class guitar player the first time I heard him. Mm. And so Doug ended up doing the tour, did the whole record, most probably 90% of the record, and he did the tour with us. And then we parted ways after that. That was the second record.
Yeah, now the Sahara album, you obviously got involved in the songwriting more from the ground up this time. Was that that you wanted to get involved in?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I loved the first record to death. I really do. And I think there's amazing moments on the record, but I really wanted to get involved in the songwriting process and put my hand on things. Where, you know, it was my idea to do Can't Find My Way Home, and because it was one of the songs that I absolutely loved mm-hmm. growing up as a kid. And I always heard it as being, you know, Led Zeppelin's answer, or House of Lords' answer to Stairway to Heaven. You know, with a nice beginning acoustic part and then rocking out in the end. So the arrangement was the band. The idea was mine. I went in with Doug Aldrich. We recorded it on a 12-track Akai, which is, back then was a decent recording machine. And when we got to doing the actual album, our producer at that point, David Soner, said, James, we've got to keep the vocal. And I said, well, I can re-sing it. He goes, you don't want to re-sing it because what you have here is the reason why everybody loves it.
Wow.
So I said, okay, great. So can you lift it? Back then, it wasn't that easy to lift a vocal off a track and put it onto another track. But he was able to do it. So that was a demo vocal on that song.
Wow.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. So, of course, that album is a little bit more guitar orientated than the first one. Was Greg on board with that as a keyboard player? Did he want to go in a heavier direction?
I think Greg is a first and foremost, he's a music lover and a businessman.
Yeah.
And he realized that the direction of music at that time was really leaning a little bit heavier than the more keyboard laden ELO, Emerson, Lake and Palmer type band that had, you know, a lot of keyboards.
Yeah.
The House of Lords, when you saw House of Lords live, there was so much energy on that stage that, you know, I could feel it as I was singing. And when you got guys like Ken Mary playing drums and Chuck Wright on bass, it was just so powerful. So the music, we realized that the band had a heavier edge to it than we realized that we were getting on record. So we actually purposely went for a heavier sound.
Now, there was, of course, two big things happened at the end of that. Is that you broke with the label, and Ken and Chuck left.
Yeah.
So was the label thing was the reason why Ken and Chuck left, or were they two completely separate things?
Well, actually, enough years has passed so I can actually tell the story of how that all happened. Chuck didn't necessarily leave.
Okay.
He was kind of like voted out. Chuck is a very passionate guy, and Greg is pretty much a businessman. So what happened was we were in Seattle, Washington, finishing a show, and we used to have this thing on the bus where we used to it was a stupid thing. Only guys in the band had with nothing better to do would think up something like this. We would like punch into our bunks and try to hit the other guy when they were sleeping, whether it be on the leg, on the arm, whatever, not to hurt them seriously, but a couple of times they'd land a good punch.
Mm-hmm.
So this became a standing thing that we did. And one night, Greg did it to Chuck, but he did it in the airport terminal while Chuck was just kind of laying down sleeping, and he hit him in the leg really hard. Chuck woke up, not in a good mood, and hit Greg back and
Wow. Just
kind of cold cocked him. So wow. Greg didn't appreciate that, and at that point, I couldn't fly back on with us on the airline. The airline would not allow him to fly because he just assaulted somebody. So that was the last. We did one last show at the Universal Amphitheater in Los Angeles after doing a show in San Diego, and that was it. And then when we got signed to Victory Records, it was Greg's decision at that point to get someone else.
Yeah. So of course you had to get a new guitar player, you know, new rhythm section. So can you tell us about getting those guys in the band?
Well, during the hiatus of finding a new label, I met Mark Baker, a friend, and Mark said, I want to write a couple of songs with you. Just, you know, he was a songwriter. He wrote songs for Signal. He wrote tons of songs for, oh my goodness, what's the band? They're kind of like in the same era of Rush, and they're in that same, they come from the same country of Canada. I can't remember the name of them. They're a famous band.
It's not Triumph, is it? No.
It'll come to me.
Yeah, okay.
I can't remember them now. But Mark had written tons of songs for them. And Rick Emmett is the singer. So what band would that be?
Rick, Triumph.
Triumph, yeah. There you go. Mm-hmm. That's the band. So Mark wrote all these songs for Triumph, and so he said, let's write some songs together. And the first two songs we wrote were What's Forever For and Demons Down.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, holy shit, this is just amazing. Again, getting on a 12-track with Kai, just him and myself in the studio. And I took the material to Greg, and Greg just like completely flipped. He just went, this is unbelievable. And he goes, I have a meeting tonight with Phil Carson, who is the head of the new label. Phil Carson is the head of Atlantic Records in England. And responsible for bands like Led Zeppelin in the early days. That's where his claim to fame was. So he got a new label here in the States called Victory, distributed by Polygram. So Greg went to dinner with Robert Plant, Phil Carson, Alana Miles, who I guess Robert Plant was seeing at the time. And he played in those two songs to Phil Carson. And Phil Carson, the next day, brought Gene and Greg into the office and offered a $500,000 contract on the spot without even seeing the band. The only stipulation he had was that he wanted Tommy Aldridge as a drummer.
Okay.
And I had no problem with that because Tommy Aldridge to me was an incredible icon. Drummers that I grew up listening to in bands and knew of his work with Whitesnake. And so that worked out great for me. Again, we hit it off, Tommy and I hit it off incredibly. I'd go down to Palm Springs and spend weekends with him, working on material, just getting to know him, and a great guy.
Yeah.
The only thing we didn't have was a guitar player. Again, left in lurch for a guitar player. So the search was on, and we found Dennis Chick, who was a great-looking guy. He wasn't the guy that really played most of the stuff on the record, because we used people like Dennis Chick. We used Mitch Perry, and we used who was the other guy we used? Pierce. I forgot his name. Something Pierce, but he's like a famous guitar player in Los Angeles. Everybody uses the guy.
Okay.
And so we used him a lot on the stuff, and Dennis Chick maybe played on one or two songs on the album. So it was one of those records where we just put together musicians, but we had the songs. The most important thing is we had songs. And also we had Sean McNabb on bass, who worked out terrific.
Yeah.
He was great with the band. He fit the band perfectly. And really, it was a strong band, a strong live band. As far as recording, like I said, we used a lot of different people.
Yeah. So. Now, to me, personally, it's one of my favorite House of Lords records. I love the first track. I love Demons Down. I think Down was in a movie, if memory serves correctly.
Hellraiser 3.
Yeah, I remember hearing it years ago in a movie. But at the time the record came out, of course, the market for that type of music was it wasn't just ye guys, it was more or less every melodic rock band at the time. It was either, you know, change or die, and it just didn't work out for you guys. So,
but it didn't work. Yeah, it didn't work out because the music industry really did change on a dime.
Yeah.
Nirvana and bands of that style were literally taking over the airwaves, and melodic rock was, and we didn't see it coming, and neither did the record company. Had they known, they probably would have either said, "Guys, this is not going to work," or they wouldn't have put so much money into recording a record. I mean, we had LA Philharmonic doing the orchestration for Demons Down and for Inside You.
Yeah.
I mean, this was not a cheap album to make. So they had their sights on a record that was really going to take off and do big numbers. So to this day, I try to get the licensing of Demons Down. They won't give it to me. I don't know what PolyGram is holding on to, but they won't let it go. And it amazes me.
Yeah,
like, we were shy. We missed it by maybe a good half a year.
Yeah, yeah. I just think it's a great record. It's just a couple of years too late. You know,
right.
I think it's probably the best of your first three. That's just my personal opinion.
Well, it was a record written there was so much creativity in the room between me and Mark when we wrote that record. That I even myself, as a, you know, as a listener, this many years that have passed, I put on that record and I go, "Oh my God, this stands up to everything that you know you'd want a record to stand up." 20 years later, you listen to it and it still sounds fresh.
Yeah,
and it's a shame. It's really a shame, but you know, look, it gives us a legacy to talk about. That's for sure.
When the band broke up and the years went by, did you ever think that the band would reunite?
No.
You never did?
No, I didn't. And basically not because I didn't think it was possible, but I had moved on so much at that point. I got married, I had a child, and I was in a totally different place. I mean, I was just into raising my daughter.
Yeah.
And I started a business in South Florida, and the business for me was so... lucrative that I didn't really care about anything at that point. I wasn't doing music. I wasn't singing. I was just, you know, working the business. It wasn't until Serafino, approached me to do a reunion with the band. And I said, "Well, look, you know, I got nothing to do and I've got a lot of time on my hands because the business was doing well and I didn't really have to work that often." So I agreed to do it. And I said, well, I'm not writing on anything. So just send me the tracks and I'll sing them. And when I got the tracks, everything was in a lower key, way lower than I'm used to singing in. And I didn't know what to think. I thought the music was great. The playing was great. You know, all those guys, Ken, Lanny, and Chuck. It was, you know, and they also used a keyboard player from Dream Theater.
Derek Sherinian.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, but the songs were just not for me. It was like, you know, putting me in Nirvana. You know, it was just never going to work. So, lo and behold, the reviews were just in the pits. I mean, reviewers hated the record. Critics hated the record. And at that point, Serafino calls me up and he says, James, can you do a House of Lords record like House of Lords used to be? And I said, yes, I definitely can. I definitely can, but I don't think Chuck and Lanny and Ken want to do a record like that. They really wanted to do something more modern sounding.
Yeah.
So it was my choice at that point to say, if you want to do a record like House of Lords, you're going to have to do it on your own and bring in the people to make it work. So that's what happened with World Upside Down. And when people found out that I was doing a record on my own without guys like Ken and Chuck, they were just, I got slammed again. This is never going to work. This is not House of Lords, the whole thing.
Yeah.
And now when World Upside Down was completed, the reviews were amazing. And it brought a new era of House of Lords, you know, to the people.
Yeah. Now, after the Power and the Myth record, who owned the rights to the name?
I did.
Oh, you had the rights. So
yes, I did.
Yeah. So can you tell me a little bit about getting that band together? Because you've more or less had the same band since. And I think like Jimmy Bell on guitar, he's amazing.
Yes. Yeah. Jimmy Bell is probably one of the best guitar players I've ever worked with. He's a force of his own right. He's just incredible to watch, incredible to listen to, and there's not too many people that I can say you can actually watch play and just go, how the hell is he doing that?
Yeah.
And he's just, you know, one of those, you know, one of a kind guitar players. And I didn't know BJ, although we worked in the same club circuit in the early days. And I certainly didn't know Chris, and Chris is much younger than I was. So when Jimmy enlisted BJ, I heard some of the stuff that he did, and I said, this guy's going to work out great. And it turns out BJ is a powerhouse. He's a motherfucker, live in every sense of the word. You know, he's just the right guy to be behind the kit. When you're a singer, he doesn't step on your vocals. He knows what to do. He's a pro.
Yeah.
And so we had a trio, and we didn't have a bass player, and then they brought in Chris, and Chris just fit in great. You know, Chris is a guy that probably came from a different, we came from one era of rock and roll, and he came from the next generation of it, but he still lived the 80s, because that's the music that he loved more than anything.
Were all the guys familiar with the earlier albums, or even your career?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, the story goes they were all House of Lords fans before they became members.
Yeah.
So that's I think the reason why we've been able to keep the band together for 10 years and still come up with fresh ideas, because they understand what House of Lords is about. And I told them, I'm not really going to change the direction of what House of Lords does, but I won't be opposed to modernizing the sound and evolving. I certainly don't want to be stuck in the 80s, but I don't want to leave the melodic structure. I want that structure to be there, but I want the production value to be updated. You know, maybe take a few chances so that we don't sound like we're just living in the past. And so they understand it, and that's the way we write the songs. Jimmy's tracks, when they come to me, sound like they could be on any Metallica record or any death metal band. I mean, this guy writes some very dark licks, but when you add a melodic melody to those heavy riffs, the combination is infectious. It really is. It's heavy and melodic at the same time.
Yeah, I remember when I picked up World Upside Down and I put it on, after the Power and the Myth I didn't really know what to expect, and it just blew me away, because as you said, it was really heavy, really melodic, and the guitar playing, the soloing on it was just incredible. Really was.
Yeah. He's just, you know, I don't know how to explain it. He is a gifted guitar player in every sense of the word, and he deserves all the credit for really bringing the band into a heavier realm. It's his guitar sound that now drives the sound of the band.
Yeah.
So and the fact that he's also, you know, a co-writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, I can't remember loving riffs like that since Richie Blackmore, when, you know, that guy used to write songs, and the themes that he came up with on his guitar were just so classic that today every guitar player on the planet wants to learn them, you know.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit, in the first couple of records that you have with the new lineup, you wrote with Jeff Kent. Can you tell me a little bit about Jeff?
Jeff was a songwriter that I worked with from New York City. He was in a band called Dreams, which was a horn. They had a horn section of the Brecker Brothers. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they're a very famous horn section. And so Jeff was a songwriter. And in the early days, before House of Lords, I used to do sessions for him in New York City. And obviously there were paid sessions. I get paid, you know, $100, $200 to sing a song, a demo for him. So we started writing a few songs together, and then we ended up writing pretty much three quarters of the record, myself, Jeff Kent, and Jimmy Bell.
Mm-hmm.
And so Jeff was a keyboard player, and he didn't come out on tour with us, but he did do a lot of the keyboards on World Upside Down.
Okay.
And we worked on two records together.
Okay.
That one and Come to My Kingdom.
Yeah. And you got Mark back for the Cartesian Dreams record?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. We got for Cartesian Dreams and Big Money.
Money is probably my favorite record you've done since World Upside Down.
Great.
I think I love the track on it, One Man Down. Can you tell us a little bit about writing that one? Yeah, it's a fantastic song.
Yeah. I remember doing that song, and I thought it reminded me of the Can't Find My Way Home days, and, you know, with the same type of, you know, approach of acoustic and then electric. But then it just had a different vibe to it, you know, completely, as far as how it turned out. It turned out way bigger and way heavier than I thought it was going to be when we started it.
Yeah.
But I have a lot of favorites on that album as well. I've got a lot of favorites on every record that we do. I really do. I mean, I don't dislike any of the records we've done since 2006, since Power and the Myth. I like a lot of stuff on every record.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and that's really, it's a testament to being able to be together with the same lineup and still keep things fresh.
Yeah.
And interesting.
Yeah. One of the other things that I like is that even when you look back at the early days of the band, you've always brought in outside songwriters to like improve the songs. And even now you still do it.
I do it for a reason. And that is, as much as we can all write and we're all capable of being songwriters, there is a method to the madness. And that is that outside writers bring in a whole different, they contribute something different than the actual band does. And they actually sometimes bring it down to earth or give it the more universal appeal that we sometimes as musicians, who are very self-indulgent, think that we can do anything. They kind of pull in the reins.
Yeah.
And say, well, no, maybe you should do this, maybe you should do that. So it's always good to write with a songwriter, an outside songwriter. Talk to Steve Tyler. Talk to John Bon Jovi. Talk to guys like this who, talk to Whitesnake. I mean, that is, not that John Sykes is an outside writer, but he was more of a songwriter than he was a performer, in my eyes, anyway.
Yeah.
He really was the driving force of Whitesnake. But I'm looking at it as, you know, bands that are super mega successful have used outside writers to help them hone this material.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, and of course, one of the other things you've been able to utilize is your wife, Robin's vocals.
Of course, that's my secret weapon. I mean, it's having her on top of what I do brings a whole other layer. And the fact that she's such a fabulous singer to begin with, I don't hide it in any way, shape, or form. The same way I didn't hide the fact that I had Mike Tramp, Jeff Scott Soto, and two or three other very well-known singers on the first House of Lords record.
Mm-hmm.
They're all over that record. High parts on top, you know, just, you know, layered and layered and layered, because that's what we had to do back then. And now we don't have the kind of budgets to bring in five, six different singers.
Yeah.
But I have Robin, who I can double track five or six times to get that layering sound on the top end. And then I do the rest of the background parts. So we both together create all those background harmonies.
Yeah. Now, does all the band get together like in the one room to record, or do you record stuff and send it via email and MP3 files?
Well, the band gets together to record the tracks.
Yeah.
In other words, I'll sing a demo of, you know, once the demo is arranged and put, and made into the song that I want it to be, then I send it back to them. And they go in there and they play it together as a band. Sometimes we do it through Skype, where I can actually see them and they can see me,
mm-hmm.
and we'll work on stuff. But after a while, we're so in tune with each other that once I send them what I want, they send me back pretty much what you hear on the record. There's very, very little of, oh, do it over, or do this, or do that. It's always pretty much they understand what I'm looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and of course you got the new record coming out, Indestructible.
Yeah.
Flower on the grave of innocence.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? Is the same approach really to Precious Metal and Big Money, or have you tried to tweak it a little bit here and there?
Well, when I wanted to do, started to record Indestructible, it was just one song after another that just kept coming at me. And the energy level, again, from what Jimmy was sending me track-wise, was so off the charts that I said, either the critics are going to love this album or they're going to just hate it. And totally, just slap it down and say, this is not House of Lords. But after the album was recorded and you listen to every song, track after track, you realize it is House of Lords, just another level from where we were from Precious Metal. We brought it, we kicked it up maybe at 5 or 6 notches, mm-hmm. and we brought Jimmy out to the forefront and just said, Jimmy, let it be your time for people to really hear what you do as a guitar player. Regardless of what the melodies are, the melodies will always be there, but let them hear these parts.
Yeah.
So we purposely brought those guitars up.
Okay. Now, in general, the melodic rock scene seems to be having a recent resurgence. Does that surprise you at all?
No, it doesn't, because everything of quality will always have their day again. Even with clothing and things like that, and cars and different things, there's always a resurgence of something. And when it's good. If it's not good, it'll pretty much be like a Studebaker, which never will have a resurge. But there's always a place and time and a place for great music. And I think melodic rock really had some great moments in the time that it was out. And right now we're enjoying that period of people just rediscovering, because, they went through maybe 15, 20 years of hearing a lot of music that wasn't really amazing.
Yeah.
It was okay. It just wasn't amazing. It wasn't groundbreaking. It wasn't Elton John. It wasn't The Who. It wasn't Zeppelin. It wasn't any of those things that just, bands that just, you could never even imagine anything like that happening today. So I think they come back to the era of the Van Halens and bands like that were just so amazing to watch. And to listen to. So, and it made you feel good. There's something feel good about melodic rock music. We didn't always take ourselves too seriously. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So, people are enjoying listening to it now. And we're really starting to see that, because we're getting a lot more interest in people wanting to book the band in different parts of the world.
Yeah,
which is a great thing. We just got one of the biggest shows in Japan called Loud Park,
mm-hmm.
and it is a huge festival, like an arena type environment. Maybe 25,000 fans go there. So this is something we're doing in October. So a lot of different things are happening this year for us.
Yeah, and did you play the festival recently that Frontiers had in Italy?
Yes.
You did?
In Milan.
Okay. Yes. So you were able to reconnect with Doug Aldrich. I believe Burning Rain played at that as well.
Yes, it did, but I didn't see him.
Oh, you
the
didn't
night
see him.
I was there, I only got to see Oney Logan and Sean McNabb.
Okay.
Doug had to leave. He played the first night, I played the second night.
Okay.
And Doug had to leave to do some kind of, I don't know if he was doing Revolutionary Saints or Revolution Saints, I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
Is that it? So he didn't stay for the second day. So I got to speak with Sean McNabb and Oney Logan, and that was it.
Okay.
And I think Oney was there with Lynch Mob.
Yeah, I believe so. I think Doug was there with, I think it was Burning Rain he was there with. I remember we spoke to him a few months ago, and I think he was planning on being there with Burning Rain.
Yeah, I didn't even know he was going to be there. I didn't know he had a project called Burning Rain, to tell you the truth.
So do you keep in touch with any of the ex-House of Lords members at all, like Greg or Ken or Chuck or Lanny?
Yes. Chuck and Lanny.
Okay.
Are the only two. I hardly ever speak with Ken, but I do a lot of Facebook with Chuck.
Mm-hmm.
And also with Lanny, when he's in the country, he's been doing a lot of traveling outside the country these days.
Okay. Do you have any upcoming tour dates to support the new record?
We start on September 25th, we start.
Okay. And any US dates, or is that a tough market now for melodic rock?
Pardon me?
The US, like, is outside the US the more or less the biggest market for you guys now, or the US is a tough market to crack?
Well, the European market right now is incredibly hot for us. So you go where the demand is. But we start a tour here in the U.S. in the last week of August, and we work our way across from Connecticut all the way to Los Angeles. And the last date we do is at the Whiskey, in September.
Okay.
So I'm excited about that because I haven't been back to Los Angeles to play since we played the Universal Amphitheater.
Okay.
So it's a very special show.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me, James, that like you've brought out albums every 2 years. You seem to be really, really enjoying yourself these days, and all the albums seem to be very well received, and they've got great songs on it. You've even brought out a solo record. So you just seem to be you're at a very prolific time of your life when it comes to songwriting.
Yeah, I guess, you know, the 10 or 11 years that I spent in hiatus, not doing anything, I accumulated a million and one ideas, and I didn't realize how much I missed it until I actually did World Upside Down and got that feeling again, that same feeling that I got the first time that I did my first record with House of Lords, which was just, it was just like waking up every morning and couldn't wait to get to work.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just, a feeling that you can't, I wish you could bottle it. I really do. I mean, it was an amazing time back then. And, you know, you don't ever want that kind of feeling to go away. And right now I've had that feeling for the last 9 or 10 years with the new guys. Now, obviously, granted, it's not the same time. You know, it's not stadiums. It's not arenas. But it doesn't matter. When you love music, it doesn't matter if you're playing for 50, 100, 1,000, 2,000. Really, if you're really a true musician, you go out there and you do the job you have to do with the people that you have.
Yeah.
And you make it work.
Yeah, no, I just got one final question for you. Now, knowing what you know now after the career you've had, if you could go back to your younger self just before the first record and give him one piece of advice, what would it be?
Well, before the record, I would have my advice would have been I would have made my journey to Los Angeles a lot earlier than I did.
Yeah.
I was a late bloomer. I was like the big fish in the big pond, I should say. I was, you know, in Connecticut, I was the guy. So I didn't want to leave that notoriety. I was afraid that if I'd gone to Los Angeles, that I would have been swallowed up by all the talent.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I should have believed what people were telling me. They were saying, James, you need to go to L.A. You need to, you know, break away and do your own thing. And if I had to do it over again, I would have started 10 years earlier.
Okay. Yeah. So, James, do you have a website, Twitter? Do you want to give those out?
My website is jameschristianmusic.com. And I have a Facebook, which, you know, you can just look up James Christian.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always, there are people that are my friends. If, you know, if somebody wanted to request me as, you know, as a friend, then they could. And I would accept them pretty more or less, I would. And they can see everything that comes out with House of Lords there and through my website.
Well, James, I've got to say, I just want to say thanks for all the great music over the years. And you're still producing fantastic music, in my opinion. And it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. It's been an absolute ball.
Oh, me too, man. Thank you very much.
No problem, James. Hopefully I'll see you out on the road this year.
You sure will.
All right. Thank you. All right. Good night.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. There we go. Richie's chat with James Christian. Hope you guys enjoyed that one, and obviously, you know, if you're digging the House of Lords stuff, you definitely want to go out and get yourself a copy of Indestructible.
Buy them all. If you're not familiar with them, buy them all.
Yeah, yeah. So, and obviously, you know, in the interview, Richie touched in on every single one of the albums, so you got a little flavor for everything that James has been involved with. So so there you go on there. So any other final words from you?
No. I'd really enjoyed that interview with James.
Yeah, good.
I'd never spoken to him before.
Yeah.
He was one of the guys I had. You know, you get a list, you tick some guys that have had a career that you really admire that you want to talk to. And he was one of them.
Yeah.
He's just an incredible singer, nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some good stories.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. Awesome. All right. So there you go. That's a wrap for this week. As usual, you can follow us on focusonmetal.net, focusonmetal.blogspot.com. You can hit up Richie on Facebook. And also, you can hear about us on Twitter. And of course, if you want to send Richie an email to say, hey, great job on that interview, it's richie@focusonmetal.net. And if you want to shoot me an email to say, why the hell weren't you on the interview, that would be scott@focusonmetal.net.
He's going to shoot me an email to say why he wasn't on the interview.
That'll do it. So for myself, Scott.
And Richie.
And everybody else here at Focused on Metal, have yourselves a good metal week. And until we talk to you again next time, remember,
focus on metal.
Everything else is insignificant.
Still here? It's over. Go home.